Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is the second hour of the program. We're here back live and we'll be taking your calls. The producers for this show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the history of New Orleans and about the ways in which the city has been shaped by its environment. Certainly, the strategic position of the city gave it considerable commercial advantages. However, it was also surrounded by swamps and was prone to flooding. In fact, the city of New Orleans contains the lowest point in the state of Louisiana and one of the lowest points in all of the United States. Much of the city today is actually located between 1 foot and 10 feet below sea level. So you can understand although the commercial considerations were there and they eventually won out, to this day, people in New Orleans struggle with the shortcomings of the location, and they have all throughout the history of the city. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking with Craig Colton. He is professor of geography at Louisiana State University and is particularly interested in urban environments and in Louisiana and the South. He's the author of a book that he wrote and was published actually before Hurricane Katrina, but certainly is relevant now as people think about and talk about rebuilding the city after it was damaged by the storm. His book is entitled An Unnatural Metropolis, Wresting New Orleans from Nature. The book is published by Louisiana State University Press, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. As always, people who are listening can call in if you have questions, comments. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. So no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Colton, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure to be here.
We certainly appreciate it. As I said, and it's certainly as you remark in the book, the advantages of locating a port there at the mouth of the Mississippi would be obvious. However, if you go and you look at the site, I don't think it probably would take you very long to realize that there would be difficulties, and they would all involve one way or another. They would involve water. When the French decided to locate the city there, how did they think about the problems that came with the site?
They were thinking very strategically about commanding the the entryway to the entire Mississippi River Valley. They were knitting together a vast colonial empire that stretched from Montreal and Canada, Quebec City, through the Great Lakes, down through Illinois, Peoria, down into Louisiana. And they wanted to have a fortification near the mouth of the river. And in spite of the fact that they realized quite early on the site flooded regularly, there were hurricanes regularly, the strategic advantages outweighed the physical limitations of the site. One thing to keep in mind here is when the French arrived there, they arrived at a place that had kind of a completely inverted topography from what they were used to. In most places around the world, along most rivers, the land climbs up as you move away from the river. I'm sure you've seen that along the Sangamon and the Kankakee and rivers in central Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the highest ground is right on the flanks of the river, and as you move away from the river, the land actually slopes gently towards sea level. So this was a very, very different situation, and the French, in some respects, denied that physical reality because some of the early promotional paintings of New Orleans to try to lure people to this inauspicious site showed mountains in the background and a topography that might have been more familiar to people back in France.
I'm looking at a cross-section map of New Orleans right now, and I'm not sure how different this is from the time that it was founded. But here, and this takes into account levees, obviously, that were constructed after the city was founded. And it looks like the highest levee on the riverside is 23 feet, and the highest on the lake side, it looks like it's about, I don't know, maybe about 12 feet. I'm not sure if that's true, but essentially that makes it look like the city is in a bowl. What can you say about the elevations at the time that the city was founded?
There was a bowl then, but it wasn't nearly as pronounced as it is today. Before any levees were built, the highest ground on what we call the natural levee, this shoulder of higher ground along the river, stood about 15 feet above sea level. Over the course of about a mile and a half to 2 miles, that land sloped back and actually dipped slightly below sea level in an area that they call the bottom of the bowl. This would just be right. There's a giant bend in the river just upstream from the French Quarter. And within that nearly semicircular arc that we call the crescent, there's a slight area that's below sea level and was at the time the French arrived. Just beyond that, though, there's a ridge that's kind of broken by a bayou that slices through it. But the ridge stood about 5 feet above sea level. So you go down from the river to the bottom of the bowl, climb back up to about 5 feet above sea level, and northward from there, the land slopes off to almost sea level. And most of that lakefront area that today is 8 to 10 feet below sea level was really right at sea level. And the Lake Pontchartrain area to the north is effectively sea level. So the topography has been modified. Once we built the levees along the lakefront and drained the water out of that marsh and swampland on the north side of the ridges, that land actually sank below. So human intervention has greatly modified the topography. It's caused huge areas of the city and its suburbs to actually sink below sea level.
So that was a question that I was getting at, to what extent human activity and that would be engineering that would actually have been intended to deal with the big problems of the site, which was the water, mm-hmm. you know, both water from Lake Pontchartrain and from the Mississippi River, and also just the fact that it's a very high water table. Trying to deal with that over time, it seems as if that has actually made things worse.
And that's an argument that's been made for decades by geographers who study hazards, that when we start manipulating nature, when we start building flood protection systems, engineered structural systems, that tends to lure people into harm's way. And even if it doesn't change the topography, it lures them in, so when the systems reach their limits, and all engineered systems have a design limit, once natural events exceed that limit, you have more people that suffer damage. The Times-Picayune ran a wonderful pair of overlay maps a couple of months ago. The Times-Picayune is the New Orleans newspaper. Mm-hmm. And it showed where people lived in 1900, which was basically limited to the natural levee, the higher land along the river. And then it showed the area that was flooded last August. And those areas were nearly perfect mirrors of each other. That is, there was no overlap between the flooding this past fall and the area that was occupied by settlers, by residents and urban development in 1900. So we have certainly, by building levees, we've accelerated subsidence of the lakefront areas and encouraged people to move into that area.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly looks as if you look at the efforts to deal with these problems, take an engineering approach to dealing with these problems over time, that it seems to me that you have sort of three main periods, say, roughly speaking, from the founding to 1900, from 1900 to 1950, and then maybe from 1950 to the present, and that when you look at those times when a more modern kind of, and these are my words, a more modern kind of civil engineering approach to the problem has been applied, that was where we had expansion into lands that some people might say arguably nobody should have been living on, and then also increased problems as a result of flooding, all those things sort of related. And again, it seems to me that that's also when we get into the modern engineering age where we might be prone to say, well, here, yeah, sure, we got some problems here, but we have modern solutions and we can deal with it. And if we just apply technology to the problem, we'll be okay.
There were several stages, and the earliest stages dealt almost exclusively with river flooding. And really since 1860s, levees, these giant earthen barriers along the river, have prevented a river flood in the city limits of New Orleans. Since during the Civil War was the last time there was a flood in the city, directly from the river. In 1900, we begin to see another major transition as the city embarked on a major coordinated public works program to drain the city, to provide good public water and good sewage service. That involved draining these mucky, peaty, soiled lakefront lands. And really, that began in 1900 and progressed on until... That began the first suburbanization of the lakefront area. That, coupled with the first hurricane protection structure, which was completed in the early 1930s, really accelerated development of that area. And in 1965, we had Hurricane Betsy, which comes a little bit later than your 1950 date, but Hurricane Betsy was a real defining moment in the history of New Orleans, because that's when major appropriations from the federal government were began to flow into the urban area to specifically develop a major coordinated hurricane protection system. And that's with that system we see true sprawl of the city into Jefferson Parish, the adjoining parish to the west, into St. Bernard Parish, the parish downriver, and into a big area called New Orleans East. And all those areas had terrible flooding, with the exception of Jefferson Parish during Katrina, and because they were areas that were ill-suited to development.
We have a caller here we'll get to, and maybe also I should introduce again the guest for anybody who might have just tuned in the last 5 minutes or so. We're talking with Craig Colton. He's professor of geography at Louisiana State University and is the author of the book, An Unnatural Metropolis, New Orleans from Nature. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Louisiana State University Press, a book that he wrote and was published before Hurricane Katrina, which takes a look at how over time people in New Orleans have struggled with the challenges posed by its location. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers here. We'll go to Indiana first, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. French artwork with the mountains, certainly an apt metaphor for the history of this city. The question I'd like for you to answer, if you could, you mentioned, I think, you know, synopsis-wise, engineering limits. Could you sort of just give us an idea, ballpark figures, about you know, what the engineering limits are, in a sense, and how much it's going to cost to do that now, and how much it will cost, you know, to keep it that way over a period of time, to give somebody some objectivity. Every time I've heard anybody talk about this, that there's at least three or four groups, and they go very quickly for the bloodline, and I just like to give something with engineering limits seems something that people could agree upon, you know, at least engineers perhaps, you know, about how high something should be, how thick, and things like that. If you could just give us some ballpark figures on, say, like to keep the old city, the one which draws the people in, how much that's going to cost, then, you know, sort of then bloop it out, you know, to we get all the parishes in, and how much it looks like down the line it would, you know, to do the job right, how much is it going to cost? Thanks a lot.
Okay. Can you try to take a shot at that?
I'll make my best stab here. I don't really have my finger on the estimates for building Category 5 levees, say, for the entire region, or even parts of it. That's really very much a moving target. But I can say this, that the current system for New Orleans was designed to withstand what they call a 200-year flood, or an event that has a probability of occurring once 1 in 200 chance of occurring every year. That's for the urban area. That's for the city of New Orleans and adjacent Jefferson Parish, which is highly urbanized, about 500,000 people there as well. The initial protection level was determined to protect against a storm of a wind of about 100 miles an hour. After Hurricane Betsy in 65, they revamped that and also revamped it with Hurricane Camille in 1969, which was a Category 5 storm with winds of up to 200 miles an hour. So they ramped up the protection to accommodate a wind speed of about 110 miles an hour for the urbanized area. For the suburban downstream parishes that have far fewer people, they only built to a 100-year flood level or a level that could accommodate a storm of about 100 miles an hour, and it had a probability of occurring once and 1% chance of occurring every year. They talked about 84 million back in 1965 as being the price tag for that. Of course, it went well over that. I've heard some numbers here in recent weeks that talk about Category 5 protection in the neighborhood of $80 billion. I quite frankly don't think that Congress or the administration will appropriate that kind of money for Louisiana right now. I think the best we can expect right now in Louisiana is a reinforcement of the current system, a strengthening, a hardening of those levees to withstand a full-fledged hurricane, a Category 3 hurricane. You have to understand that wind speeds in New Orleans only reached 85 miles an hour. That's a Category 1 storm, and the levees failed. But the basic physics involved are that the storm surge was well over a Category 1 surge. It continued. The momentum was already in place in the hurricane storm surge, which caused the damage. It overtopped the levees in some areas and broke them in others. But that storm surge exceeded Category 1 and was probably a Category 3. That was the design limit for those levees, and they failed very close to their design limit. Maybe prematurely, maybe not. I don't know. And there's teams of engineers studying that. I'm not in a position to make a conclusive statement, but the levees did fail. I think the commitment now is to restore them so they won't fail in a Category 3 storm.
Just yesterday, I believe that it was, the mayor, Mr. Nagin, Ray Nagin, was talking about the approach to rebuilding the city. And apparently he says now that he thinks that residents should be allowed to rebuild any place they want as long as they do that at their own risk. And it seems to me that that's just now another chapter in a long sort of controversy about whether or not people should be allowed to return to low-lying areas that sustained the greatest damage. Other people have said, no, it doesn't make any sense for us to go back and rebuild there because we're courting disaster, that such a thing might happen again, and it just doesn't. There are certain areas of the cities that never made sense to develop them, and we shouldn't, and that what we should do is make them into parks or green spaces or something, but people shouldn't live there. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some quotes from you essentially saying sort of something like that, at least, you know, that the idea that everything that was destroyed should be rebuilt the way that it was doesn't make a whole lot of sense. What do you think about that very question, and whether or not people should be allowed to go back and rebuild in places that were destroyed by the aftermath of Katrina?
I really think it's tragic that people who are running for office right now are so committed to securing votes that they're willing to encourage people to go back and move into harm's way. This goes against almost four decades of national flood insurance policy. a national flood policy to try to discourage people from returning to harm's way. Now, there are some areas in New Orleans that were hard hit that are not in the lowest ground, parts of the lower Ninth Ward, although they were flooded during Betsy severely. They were flooded again during Katrina, but they're on the higher ground. And if we follow some logical approach of trying to limit development in the lowest areas and redevelop perhaps a slightly higher density on the higher ground, most of the lower Ninth Ward should be included in the rebuilding plans if we build levees secure enough to prevent flooding. Those levees have failed twice. It's the levee failure that produced the flooding, not people putting themselves in harm's way in some areas. In parts of the lakefront area, in parts of the New Orleans East, we have incredibly low-lying areas. Federal programs, state programs, local programs should be developed to help transplant those communities to slightly higher ground, not to abandon them, not to abandon their equity in those homes. But we should find ways to help communities relocate, transplant. Everybody who wants to come back should be allowed in, and that should be that's been a fundamental part of what I've tried to argue all along. But we should help them move out of harm's way, and then we should transfer those lowest areas into more sensible land uses, such as flood retention basins and and perhaps parks. There's been a lot of talk in recent weeks that maybe that's going to actually happen. And the mayor actually concedes that that very well may happen because people are not going to get insurance in some of those low areas. So it's just it's really deceptive to try to say on one hand, we want people to go back wherever they want to, but at the same time say they're probably not going to get insurance, they're probably not going to get loans. So the mayor seems to want the federal government, FEMA, the banks, the lending institutions to be the bad guys and not make those bold decisions and not be truly a humane individual and try to take people out of harm's way.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else here. Belgium nearby, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I don't know quite where to begin with this to make my point. Back in the late 80s, we were watching a World Series baseball game, and an earthquake hit San Francisco.
Yes.
Very much a similar sort of incident. It didn't kill as many, it wasn't quite the same magnitude, but still, it caused a real problem. Now, the people of California and San Francisco enacted laws saying, well, new construction is going to be this way, and bridges are going to be improved this way and that way. And they've gone on, maybe not enough to solve all the problems, but they've moved in a direction that solves their own problems on their own soil. Now, let's move to Katrina. Now, sure, Katrina is a much larger event, but the real problem in New Orleans was the flooding. So you have to solve the problem with flooding. You say, well, okay, we get build bigger dikes, but that's really not probably the way it should be thought about. If these people want to move back, let's look at a different engineering way and solve their problem with their own legislation, saying, if you want to move back, you've got to get yourself out of flooding's way. So there's another way of doing it is to put the buildings on stilts. The flood comes, the flood goes, the house is still there and saved, and make people who wish to come back to those areas come back with modifications to their building plans that have to solve the problems that are there at the spot. What are your feelings in people actually taking a hand in their own destiny like that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's incredibly important, and I think the local government needs to take a lead in that. And any effective program is going to require multiple dimensions to flood protection. First and foremost is efforts to restore the wetlands. In Louisiana, and the Corps of Engineers and the federal government and the state have been working for several decades now to try to restore the wetlands. Those wetlands create a buffer, and as the storm surge comes in, they tend to dampen that storm surge. So every mile of coastline you can restore, you can reduce the storm surge by about a foot. So if we can restore the wetlands, that makes the current levee system more effective. Strengthen that levee system, certainly. at least to the design specifications. Then once you move inside that levee system, create some open spaces in the lowest lying areas. And I've always advocated, along with that, in those intermediate zones, zones that maybe are 2 or 3 feet below sea level, build raised houses. This was a design strategy used by New Orleans people, particularly in the 1920s, as they began expanding the city into flood-prone areas. There's whole neighborhoods where you see houses raised 5 or 6 feet above grade, and they have garages underneath. This is this same design principle is a core component of the current flood protection plan nationally. And New Orleans needs to move a little bit more aggressively to require higher houses. I think you're right there, and I think raised houses are part of this. But you can't raise all houses that high. It just gets prohibitive in terms of cost. So you open some areas up, you raise houses in intermediate zones, and then you increase the density on the slightly higher ground.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, sure. Thanks for the call. We are at our midpoint here, just a little bit past. We have a couple of other callers. Let me introduce once again a guest. He's Craig Colton. He's professor of geography at Louisiana State University, teaches courses on the geography of Louisiana and historical geography of the environment, and is the author of the book, An Unnatural Metropolis, Wresting New Orleans from Nature. It's published by the Louisiana State University Press. It was something that he actually wrote before the hurricane, but it takes a look at how over time people in New Orleans have dealt with the problem of their location, one problem being possibility of flooding from the river or from the lake, Lake Pontchartrain, and the other is the kind of problems that come with just having a very high water table and having it be a swampy place. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455 are the numbers to call if you want to join in on the conversation. To somebody else here, Lovington, this is next line number two. Hello.
I got a couple questions, I guess. I'll just spit them out and hang up. It's beyond me why that anybody would want to move back, and I guess I'd like to hear your reasons why you think this whole place just shouldn't be abandoned, to be real blunt. And my other question is, how will you ever quit, or how are they ever going to stop the subsidence under developed areas that, you know, just doesn't guarantee that it's just going to keep getting lower? Thank you.
Okay.
Well, you know, I sometimes ask the same question. I've been in places. I lived in Illinois back in the 1990s and was witness to all the flooding along the Mississippi and Missouri, and watched all the people rush down and join the sandbag brigades. And I watched, I went to countless public meetings after those floods in 1993, and I heard all this talk about, well, why don't we knock down some of the levees, move whole communities up on the terraces, on the bluffs, and reopen some of the floodplain to river use during floods. There were a few small-scale experiments with relocating whole communities, but no big communities, no substantial number of people were moved off the floodplain because people have deep roots in Illinois and elsewhere to the places that they live. Some people just simply like living near the river. New Orleans has and South Louisiana in general has a particularly deep set commitment to place. People have attachments here. Families live multiple generations in their same homes, just like a lot of Illinois families used to live multiple generations on their farms. They do it in an urban context in Louisiana. Louisiana has one of the highest rates, highest percentages of people who grow up and live and die in the same county or parish, as we call them down here. So people simply are tied to place. Sometimes that attachment overrides common sense in terms of flood risk. People look back and they say, well, there was a big hurricane in 1915, in 1947, in 1965, and now in 2005. They think, well, you know, odds are I'm not going to see another one of those in my lifetime. It's the same rationale that people use who live along rivers and who put themselves back in harm's way repeatedly. I know along Peoria Lake, the Corps of Engineers has bought out a bunch of homes and summer camps because people are seeing repeat flooding in that area in the 80s and 90s. So sometimes it takes a little push from government to help people release their ties to place. So it's just simply attachment and long-standing familiarity with an area that make people want to move back. Now, I guess Dennis Hassett was saying, why bother rebuilding? Well, there's a tremendous amount of public infrastructure invested in New Orleans. It's a port. It serves the rest of the country. It handles grain from Illinois and Iowa and throughout the Midwest. That's one good reason to keep that city open. You can't operate the port without some people there to operate it. They're much more mechanized than they used to be, certainly, but you do need a population to manage the ports. You need population there to deal with a lot of the oil infrastructure in the southern part of the state that provides fuel for American consumers across the country. Natural gas flows from Louisiana. It's refined in the area around New Orleans. So maintaining a good share of the oil industry in the country requires that we maintain a city like New Orleans. And the fact that millions of people want to come here to get a taste of the joie de vivre, as they say here, a little bit of the New Orleans culture, the restaurants, the food, the Festival of Mardi Gras, and other things. New Orleans has been a very important contributor to American culture, and for one of the, that's another reason. I think for that reason alone, it's worth the investment in protecting the city. But, and there are many other reasons, such as oil and gas and the port and tourism in general.
Mm-hmm. The other question was about the subsidence problem that has resulted from the drainage efforts that have gone on around the city.
Well, there's no way to stop subsidence in that area, particularly in the areas where we've seen suburban development on marshy soils. Some people say, well, why don't you divert river water in and let it deliver sediment to those areas and build them back up on a regular basis? One, the river doesn't carry nearly as much sediment as it used to because it's all being trapped in Sangamon Lake and all the reservoirs throughout the Midwest and the Great Plains. So that the really important sediment is already filtered out by a whole string of locks and dams in the Ohio and the Illinois and the Missouri and other tributaries of the Mississippi and the Mississippi itself. The thing is, you need to employ land use approaches which minimize development of those flood-prone areas. You build on the natural levee, which is not subsiding as fast, and then couple that with coastal restoration, you can protect the city from a lot of the subsidence problems.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Pasotum, line number three. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a question. I had a chance to visit Holland, the Netherlands, and I was just really impressed by the huge systems of drainage and pumping and so forth that goes on in that nation, actually. I don't know how much. I'm not sure how big it really is. But farms and everything, we had the opportunity to visit a number of farms and talk to them about their, well, actually, it's a big drainage district that they all pay into to help contribute to the keeping the drainage up. So I guess there's two questions. One, are if you are familiar with how old that system is and how it keeps working and how it compares to New Orleans problems, and then, you know, does New Orleans generate enough revenue to be able to afford to, you know, maintain its drainage system itself without, you know, a lot of federal assistance?
Yeah. In terms of the Dutch system, that whole system was set in motion after a giant North Sea storm in 1953. It wasn't completed until the 1980s, so it was a 30-year-plus project. The hurricane protection system in New Orleans was a 40-plus-year project. It's still, even when Hurricane Katrina came in August, it was not finished. They were still building the system that was designed in roughly 1965. So New Orleans, well, the Dutch system was a long-term investment. There's something like 6 to 8 million people in the Amsterdam-Rotterdam urban area, which is protected by that. There's only 4 million people in the entire state of Louisiana. It's a national project. New Orleans, although it's nationally funded, would only be really serving a local population of 1.5 million, 2 million if you stretch it. So there's great there's a much greater rationale, an economic rationale, to invest in a much larger system in Holland. Mm-hmm. Also, they'll never see a Class 3 hurricane in Rotterdam or in Holland. They don't have hurricanes there. They have North Sea storms, which can blow in over 100 miles an hour, hurricane strength, but they're not going to produce the same kind of storm surge as a Gulf hurricane. They don't have the same kind of configuration of offshore, a gentle slope coming in, which produces higher storm surge that we do. They're not sinking as rapidly, so we can invest in a system that is more permanent there. There's rock underneath the delta. There's not rock underneath our delta. So it's a very different set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I think they built for a 1 in 1,000-year storm, and we're built for a 1 in 200-year storm. So they've built it to much higher standards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not Louisiana can afford to pay for its own defenses, probably not. Certainly not New Orleans, and probably not Louisiana. But it is a national investment because, once again, shipping of cargo from throughout the Mississippi River Basin requires a city near the mouth of the river. And so there is a rationale for national investment. New Orleans has always passed off its flood protection expenses to the national government since 1850, 1849 even.
It'd be like Champaign County having to pay for Interstate 57 and 74 and 72, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You need some national support to it. But I was curious about the similarities as
yeah.
far as. But that system's a lot older in Holland, isn't it, than 30 years? I mean,
well,
they were pumping for almost a century or more, weren't they?
Well, the New Orleans levees, they began building them in the 1720s.
In New Orleans?
In New Orleans, they began building riverfront levees in the 1720s. The federal government really took full-fledged control of the process in the 1880s, and the hurricane protection system began in the 1940s, but really in a coordinated and more extensive way in 1965.
And how's that compared to Holland then, as far as age? So,
well, they began their system in the 1950s. We began really the full fledged system in the 1960s here. So theirs is a little bit older, but the Corps of Engineers will probably tell you the Dutch engineers came over here and talked to the Corps of Engineers first before they started building it.
Okay. You mean I? For some reason, I understood that they've been pumping water in Holland since the 1500s.
Oh, absolutely. They have been building levees and dikes since certainly the 1600s. But the big system that we all see pictures of since Hurricane Katrina was really begun in the 1950s.
Yeah. It just always begs the question, well, why did, in Holland anyway, why did you come here anyway if you had to pump water all the time? That was kind of what my... New Orleans, we know, because the port, you know, that made a lot of sense.
Well, and the initial city was built on land where you didn't have to pump water all the time.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Up until 1900, they lived on dry land.
Right.
It was subject to flooding, but...
So why did Holland go where they went, where they had to pump water? Is it
Well, they dug all the peat out. They dug a lot of the peat out, and the land subsided. They created part of their problem as well.
Oh, okay. All right, well, I appreciate the information. I've always been curious about how people will go to such efforts, you know, in any part of the world to live where they want to live.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Our guest, by the way, in this part of Focus 580 is Craig Colton. He's professor of geography at Louisiana State University, author of the book An Unnatural Metropolis, looking at the history of New Orleans and its struggle to deal with its environmental shortcomings. The book's published by Louisiana State University Press, and we have about 10 minutes left in the program. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something that we have not touched on, I'm interested in getting you to talk about, is this relationship between environment and engineering and ultimately what life is like in the city. And particularly, I guess I'm interested in whether engineering efforts to deal with the environmental issue contributed to a kind of a polarization in the city between rich and poor. over time? And particularly, I'm interested in something like, for example, could you simply draw a sort of a straight line between whether how much money people had and what the elevation of their house was? Could you guess just by their elevation of their home how much money they had?
Not at all. And you certainly can't draw a map showing the areas impacted by flooding and a particular race. There's this wide swath of land across the area near the lakefront that contain people, most people of a middle-class to upper-class background, but it included very distinct black neighborhoods and very distinct white neighborhoods. All suffered terrible flooding. The one dimension of kind of racial segregation and poverty being accentuated by the engineering system really occurred in the early 20th century when the drainage of the city led some people to move from some of the low areas of the city, some of the older parts of the city that were subject to flooding, out towards the newly developed lakefront. So you had middle-class people moving from older neighborhoods to newly protected districts. And oftentimes those newly protected districts near the lake actually had special covenants in the deed that said black people can't buy these homes. Those kind of provisions have been since overturned by the Supreme Court, but that was common in the 1920s. There were other neighborhoods that were set up exclusively for African-American residents. So you had very clear racial segregation going on in areas that were seen as safe, but that were subsiding behind the newly developed levees. In the areas those people left, the low areas in the city, you tended to have people of low income and who were African American move into those areas because they were less desirable and less expensive, and people without much money could afford to live there. So there you had a concentration of generally impoverished residents living in some of the lowest ground of the old city. And those areas also flooded during Katrina.
I know we talked a little bit earlier about some of the controversy and discussion about development and that some people in government, the mayor, for example, saying that as far as he was concerned, he thinks that anybody should be able to come back and rebuild where they were as long as they're willing to take the risk. And you said that, in fact, the reality is that maybe even if people wanted to, they probably wouldn't be able to. At least they wouldn't be able to get insurance if they had done that. So in spite of all the talk about wanting to let people who were driven out by the flood go back and rebuild, it seems unlikely that that's going to happen. Maybe there's the question to ask is do you think, as some people do, that New Orleans has been forever changed by the damage that resulted from Katrina, and that it will never be the city that it had been at one time?
Oh, I think so. I think New Orleans, I guess I saw today the RAND Corporation was now projecting maybe 56% population by 2008, so 2 years out. We're just beginning to get a grip on how much this is going to affect New Orleans. I go back on occasion, and I was just back last week for the first time in almost 2 months, the longest span between visits since the hurricane. And there's still tremendous inertia, tremendous numbers of neighborhoods, mile after mile of residential property, where there's people aren't living. You see more and more FEMA trailers pulled up in front of houses, people optimistic, people wanting to move back in, people dedicated to restoring their houses. Some of the low income neighborhoods where for months no one was returning. I'm beginning to see life in those neighborhoods again. People gutting their houses, which is the first sign that they've come back. The first stage is they throw their refrigerators out, and then you see all the sheetrock and the interior material that shows that they're gutting their houses. That's going on. There's been a tremendous number of volunteers from around the country, college students coming on spring break, volunteering to gut houses. So there's a real concern nationally and a real generosity on the part of people from around the country to help out. But no matter how many houses we gut, that's still not going to make all areas of the city really habitable in all respects. The city might not, and in spite of the fact the mayor's telling people to move back where they want to, he's also saying we might not be able to provide infrastructure. We might not be able to provide sewage and water. We might not be able to provide police protection and fire protection if there's not enough people in those neighborhoods. So he's really being unrealistic in kind of enticing people to move back. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll see we have to see a much smaller city, whether by design or by just the natural process of city restoration. It's going to be a smaller city. I would hope, I would hope it would have some of the cultural richness that it did before. That's the one thing that I would hate to see disappear.
You know, just a couple of weeks ago here on the program, I had a chance to talk with one of your colleagues there at Baton Rouge, Andre Codrescu.
Yes.
He was here, and we talked about New Orleans and about some of his experiences there and his feeling about the city and the things that he has written about it. He's just now published a book that collects, I think, he said, everything that he'd written about New Orleans during the time that he'd been living there. And one of the things that he says in writes in one of the pieces is that he feels that it's difficult for people who live in other cities to understand how New Orleanians feel about the place that they live. And certainly he waxes poetic, as is his nature, about the place. Can you talk about, I wonder, do you have a feeling about, particularly now since you're a geographer and you're interested in the environment and connection between the environment and how people live, how the environment, the nature of the place shapes the character of the place and how that hooks into or how that maybe creates the way that people feel about it?
Well, when people first visit New Orleans, I think they always first see the decrepit nature, the decay, the ramshackle state of so many of the buildings. And that is a product of this subtropical environment that encourages termites and encourages kudzu, and which we don't see in the city really, but it encourages other vines. When you stop maintaining a house for just an instant, it shows signs of age and wear. And it's that ambiance of decay that in part makes New Orleans such a unique place. It's the visual landscape that's falling apart before our very eyes, yet at the same time is one that's so different from every American city. Other cities don't have the kind of architecture that we have in New Orleans, maybe little bits and pieces of it, but nothing is sprawling, nothing is pervasive. And of that, the architecture is, of course, adapted to the environment, high ceilings and long, narrow houses that accelerate the ventilation of winds that blow through them. So everything about the architecture of the city is a adaptation to a tropical or subtropical environment. And those things all, of course, contribute to the look of the place. The foodways, of course, also very much reflect the local resources. Rice and okra brought in by Africans, the seafood collected from the local waters all create a really interesting cuisine, which is also very much a product of the locale.
One of the things that certainly has happened over the life of the city is that a vast amount of coastal wetland has been lost. And environmentalists are concerned about that, have been for a long time, and there certainly also is, there is a connection between the ability of the land in a city like New Orleans to take the hit of a big storm and the amount of wetland. And there are a lot of people talking about wetland restoration. How significant has that effort been, and do you think that actually is going to continue?
I think it must continue. I think if we're to invest a single cent in New Orleans, we should invest equal number of cents in coastal restoration, because coastal restoration will make any improvements in the city viable and long-term. And without them, we're throwing money in a hole. Before the storm, there were proposals to secure $14.5 billion for coastal restoration. That's a drop in the bucket compared to what we've already spent in restoring the city. And that might not have eliminated flooding, but it certainly would have dampened the storm surge. And so coastal restoration investment is money well spent from the national level. And the Louisiana delegation is trying to encourage Congress to allow us to siphon a bit of proceeds from the outer continental shelf oil, the oil taken from the deep waters. Texas, for example, is able to obtain royalties from oil extracted up to 10 miles offshore. Louisiana, by virtue of the fact that we were not a Spanish colony, can only secure revenue for oil royalties from oil taken up to 3 miles offshore. So we have a much narrower band that we can secure federal dollars from. If we were allowed to take a piece of the revenues from the oil that everyone in this country uses and depends on, we could restore our coast without really making a major hit on the federal budget. And I think that's one way that we can fund coastal restoration and make sure that it does take place. And then that makes every dollar and every cent invested in the city pay bigger dividends in the long run.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it because we're here at the end of the time. The book, I want to mention the title one more time, An Unnatural Metropolis, Wresting New Orleans from Nature, published by the Louisiana State University Press, by our guest, Craig Colton. He's professor of geography at LSU at Baton Rouge. And Professor Colton, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.